And it is 9 a.m. in the West Coast. It is 12 noon in the East Coast. And it's 7 p.m. in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Today is August 2nd, 2017. And this is Orly Benny Davis with Impossible Truth. Today on BBS Studio, we are having Doug Newsom. Thank God for him. And we are going to try to touch base with all the news that we are concerned with. And we would like to share with you. And I hope that you have fun and you enjoy it and you understand that this is coming from the heart to you, and we hope to do a good show. All right, let's start. For a beginning, I want to start with a very important message. A message from a Jordanian, an Arab friend, a neighbor of Israel, that sent me a request to communicate his words to everyone. It's because of concern. Let's tell you the background of this. Of course, Israel and Jordan had some standoff in the last few days because the Al-Aqsa compound, the Temple Mount area that was, was devastated by an attack. It was a terrorist attack. It was a Muslim attacking guards, Israeli guards, which they were Druze. They weren't even Jewish. They were Arab. And then follow up, there was like some kind of a shoot up. People really lost their life, and there was a stand up. And we had 2 weeks of irregular rioting, kind of, but they played good. They went and left, okay? However, there was a situation in Jordan which a guy from the Israeli embassy in Amman was translocating some of his belonging, I don't know, in the apartment. And there was a delivery guy that got probably upset. And it was the same days of the rioting in Jerusalem. And he tried to stab him with a screwdriver. Of course, the Israeli security man, trained as it is, he shoot the guy and he killed him, obviously. But in the same token, he killed also the owner, the property owner, that it was a sad incident. But that's what happens when you are attacked. You are not sure who you're shooting back. It's not easy. It's collateral damage. That's what they call it. Now, the Israeli government did everything in its power to bring the security men and the apparatus of the embassy back to Israel. Of course, there was a picture opportunity for the prime minister to rub his shoulder to say, hey, I did a good job, I brought it. And the king of Jordan got mad. He got so mad that the parliament also got mad with him, and there was a fighting. And there was exchange of words, a fist fight in the Jordanian parliament. And sure enough, they talk over the net, and the Israeli parliament member was talking back to them. And this morning, the Israeli parliament member was invited to a match by the Jordanian policymakers. They wanted to have a gate of Allenby, the gate of the exit entry to Israel from Jordan. They wanted to have a stand-up. 10 o'clock in the morning, they're calling the member of parliament in Israel, and they ask him, are you going? He said, yes, I'm going. I'm trying to convince this guy that nothing happens, that he needs to calm down. We just want, Palestinians have their own state, which is Jordan, he thinks, okay? Which 90% of the population is Palestinian, but let's assume that it's his policy, okay? The Prime Minister Netanyahu called this morning. We're talking about like cowboy, the match, calling, let's meet at the gate of, the entries, Allenby gate. It was incredible. On the radio, we all freaked out. 10 a.m. in the morning, the prime minister called the member of the Knesset and told them, there is no go. You aren't going anywhere. You cannot meet with this guy. This is foreign affair. This is Jordan. This is the kingdom of Jordan, which we have a very precious, precious peace accord. And sure enough, he turned back and he said, we'll meet another place. I arrived to my office to get an email from my friend. And my friend is an activist. He works hard to have a peace between nation, collaboration. His name is Lawrence Awad. And he wants to help the refugees there. He wants to collaborate. And if we get the World Food Organization to come and organize some, you know, massive food to distribute all around, we can actually start moving this cooperation between the nations around here. So his communication is as follow. This is from Lawrence Awad. Please communicate my words to everyone. What brings us together is much more than what would divide us. I'm just reading to you. We in Jordan look forward to solving this problem by presenting the cause to a fair trial of all parties in Israel and broadcasting it in the media. We should not stop at this small problem. Peace needs more courage than war. We can work for a minimal meeting of two meetings. We can go to high organization to support our logistic for meetings. And we can, from a lobby supporting this movement, which must be stronger than the presence of embassy in the two capitals. Everyone should know that the voices of peace are higher than violence, terrorism, and war. Greeting to all of you. Lawrence Awad, I did my share. I share it with the world. I told everybody that we want to create some kind of a meeting so we can coordinate and organize. Actually, we need to start cooperating to help relieve the unimaginable, incredible situation in Syria, the refugee camps in Lebanon, and of course in Jordan. So from here, Israel, I'm sending my Jordanian friends from across the border message of love, friendship, and cooperation, and the will of God, with the will of God, we can make a difference. So I trust we will. All right. Now going back to what we have to be concerned of, if we are worthy before God, because if you remember, I was talking so many times about Jerusalem, about the needs, and the truth of the matter is, member of Knesset Ari Glick said yesterday in an incredible segment, which was outstanding. He said, this city is the city of God. Whoever wants to pray here in Jerusalem, please come and do so. Whoever wants to fight, don't come. It's not your place. The place is for worship. This is a place that we need to neutralize all hatred. That's where we have to come together. Now think about it. The custodian of this city is by the biblical accord, you know, biblical grant is the Jewish faith. And why is that? Because we're little, we're small in amount, and we need to make a difference. And we are, you know, between everybody, we can handle it, okay? So we're not talking that you, everybody is more or less. We're just talking who is handling the show. Okay, so Jerusalem is now under Israeli jurisdiction, and we're trying to handle the show. And we're trying to make everybody pray here. If the king and, you know, all the WAQA organization will understand that prayer is not an hostile. It's not something that desecrates a place. Prayers is something that sanctifies the place. So I'm talking again, and I want you to listen to what Rabbi Sacks, the former head rabbis of London, talks about Jerusalem, what he says about that. Thank you.
There has never been a love story like it in all of history, the love of this people for that city. Jerusalem is mentioned something like 660 times in Tanakh. And even though the temple was destroyed twice, and even though the city has been besieged 23 times and captured and reconquered 44 times, Jews never ceased to pray for Jerusalem, about Jerusalem, and facing Jerusalem. Somehow, it was where every Jewish prayer met and ascended to heaven. And there's been nothing like it. Other cities, other faiths may hold Jerusalem holy, but they have holier places. Rome, Constantinople, Mecca, Medina. Jews only had this one city. A tiny city, but somehow it was the place, said Maimonides, from which the divine presence was never exiled. In those critical and tense weeks before the Six-Day War, I was just coming near the end of my first undergraduate year at Cambridge University. And for the 3 weeks beforehand, we all felt that something terrible was going to happen after all the troops were massed on the Egyptian and Syrian borders. And all of us, all of my generation born after the Holocaust, feared that we were about to witness a second Holocaust. All the Jewish students, vast numbers of them, turned up in the little shul in Thompson's Lane to pray. I've never seen so many people there before or since. The atmosphere was absolutely intense. And for me, it was life-changing. As soon as we saw the paratroopers, as soon as we heard the words Harabayat Biyadenu, I knew I had to go there and see it for myself. And I went there, and looking down from Haratzofim, from Mount Scopus, down on the old city, I suddenly realized that I was standing at the very place that the Mishnah and Gemara talk about at the end of Makot, when Rabbi Akiva and three of his rabbinical colleagues are standing on Haratzofim, looking down on the ruins of the temple, and the other rabbis are weeping, and Rabbi Akiva is smiling. And he says, "Why are you weeping?" And they say, "Look, the Holy of Holies, and it's ruins. A fox is walking through there. The place that only the holiest man, the high priest, could enter only on the holiest day, and now it's ruins. Of course we're weeping. Why are you not weeping?" And Rabbi Akiva said, "Because there were two prophets who gave prophecies. One, Micha, saw the city in its destruction, and another one, Zechariah, saw it rebuilt. And saw it as a place where Od Yeshvu Zekenim Zekenot Berchovot Yerushalayim, where old men and women would sit at peace in the streets of Jerusalem, and the streets would be filled with the sounds of children playing. So if I have seen the fulfillment of the prophecy of destruction, am I not convinced that there will one day come true the prophecy of rebuilding and restoration?" And as I stood where Rabbi Akiva stood 2,000 years earlier, I said to myself, if he had only known how long it would take, would he still have believed? And then I suddenly realized, of course he would still have believed, because Jews would never give up hope of Jerusalem. We never allowed it to escape our minds. In any of our prayers, at our weddings, we remember Jerusalem. Every time we comfort mourners, we say, "Amakom yenachem etchem betoch sha'avelei Tzion v'Yerushalayim." You know, Jews were a circumference whose center was Jerusalem. And I suddenly realized that people that could never forget this holy city would one day come back. And as I stood there, soon after the Six-Day War, I suddenly realized that faith brought back Jews to Jerusalem and will one day rebuild its ruins. That is the most powerful testimony of faith I know. What's special about Jerusalem today is, despite all the tensions which are real, nonetheless, it's a place, the Holy of Holies, still to Jews. But also on the Temple Mount are two mosques. It's a place of prayer for Muslims. There in the Old City are some of the holiest churches in the whole of Christendom. So it is, nonetheless, a city of peace. One of the very few places in the Middle East, one of the very few places in the world, holy to three distinct faiths, where those faiths pray together in freedom and in peace. And that's come only under Israeli rule in the last 50 years. Somebody once said about Israel, and you could certainly say this about Jerusalem, that it's not that long and it's not that wide, but it's very deep. So Jerusalem is very deep. And somehow within its relatively narrow confines, it contains, in Walt Whitman's phrase, multitudes. The other incredible thing about Jerusalem is that somehow magic happens with our sense of time. So, for instance, the walls of Jerusalem were destroyed by every conqueror and then rebuilt using the stones that had the previous walls. So if you look at the stones of the walls around Jerusalem, they come from all the eras, somehow past and present, the old and the new are all jumbled together. And then you think of this city, the oldest of the old, and yet Time magazine a couple of years ago listed Jerusalem as one of the top five in the world, which is an emerging center of high tech. So it's the oldest of the old, and it's the newest of the new. It is the living symbol of what Theodore Herzl titled his book about the return to Zion, Alt Neuland, the old new land, the old new city for the old and renewed people.
All right, we are back. That was Rabbi Jonathan Sacks from England, which we cannot even try to explain how well he speaks about Jerusalem and how well he speaks about Judaism. He understands the spirit of the nation. And what we want to give you in this moment is the understanding that a city of God is a city that needs to be preserved. It's not the idea of having a property. It's not real estate. It's observation of holiness. And remember, when you go to a holy place, you go to shul, you go to church, you go to mosque, you prepare yourself. And think about a city that we want to prepare for the holy, to make it holy grounds. And it takes effort. And I really would like everybody to understand that in the world, there are a few places that people give you the sensation that they keep holy. Like you go to the Vatican. You know, it's all the entrance. You can see you can feel the movement of people, the excitement. They're going to do something incredible because they watch all the architectural, the arts that brought us through the nation from ages, from Michelangelo. You will see the cathedral. You will understand how much work was put in a place they want people to worship. And think about Jerusalem. What happens is they build it again and again and again because this is a city of God. And every generation, somebody wants to make awesome gesture for that. And I respect the Muslim respect to the holy city, of course. But there is also rights of others. And there are the rights of the Jewish people, which we got the space because we came back to our homeland. And how many times I can repeat it, but it seems like the conflict is everlasting and we want to break that cycle of violence. We want to come to an agreement, like the Jordanian reach out across the border today. And I saw him on the social media. He was fighting for peace. People don't want. They want to fight. But look what they did all these years. They created a mess of trash. Look at Gaza. I was thinking about Gaza because I saw pictures and I know people that came to the hospital, you know, children that with mommy and daddy, the beautiful people that come from Gaza. And I'm looking there, and there is all the rubbles of the last war, 2014. They received tons of money. They're talking about, they want to build. Why don't anybody from the world, I'm not talking about them, there is a time that the world is lacking. And this organization that we're all paying the dues for so many years, like United Nations, needs to come to play. Think about it. Think about it. There is constructions to be made, but the ruins, the one that was, they're all trash. It's all trash. You need to take a big truckload of trash and throw it elsewhere. Consume it. Do whatever you want with it, but start cleaning the place up. Let's start with cleanup. This is a time to a big call to all the construction workers all around the Middle East. We need to start building, and building starts with clearing up the area. If you do that, we can have a new day. And having said that, I think that we are ready for the next segment. Now, on the segment, the new segment is about history again. What happens is I need to give you perspective. I know that it's not talked about in clear voice. I know that all the nonsense of, fighting always comes around. And I want to give you the chance to see it. So I'm giving you perspective. Let's listen to it and see what we can learn from that. If you have any question, if you have any idea that you want to share with me, you can always write us at BBS Radio online. All right, let's listen to it.
So three separate treaties going on regarding the same land. Look at how double dealing, how duplicitous, how hypocritical, how backstabbing the Brits were here. Three different agreements. While all of this is going on, guess what? 1914, talk begins in the British cabinet at the highest levels of promising a Jewish homeland to the Zionists. Talk begins of now carving out an independent Jewish homeland and giving it over to the Zionists. Now pause here, who were the Zionists? The Zionists were a movement that began in the late part of the 19th century. A group of influential, powerful Jews in Europe began this movement, which was called Zionism. They called it Zionism, and it was called the World Zionist Federation Council. And the goal of Zionism was the establishment of an independent Jewish homeland, preferably in Jerusalem itself. Now, this is in 1880s, 1890s. They're already talking about this type of talk. And the most influential people in this movement were Theodor Herzl, who's basically the founder of the Zionist movement, and then Chaim Weizmann, who eventually becomes the first president of Israel. Now, interestingly enough, in the beginning, the Brits tried to promise them another land. And they said, why don't you choose Uganda in Africa? It's easier for us. Go to Uganda. We'll give you Uganda. Have your own independent land in Uganda. Now remember, the Brits controlled one-fourth of the world at the time. The Brits controlled much of Africa and India and all of these lands, the Far East, they're all under British control. And many countries in Africa were British protectorates. So they wanted to give a country they felt wouldn't be problematic. So they tried to convince them to take Uganda. And if they had said yes, history would have taken a whole different turn. Israel would have been in Africa. In the heart of Uganda, there'd be Israel over there, right? But they insisted, no, we only want Jerusalem. Our eyes are on the prize. We want Jerusalem. And eventually the British negotiated out and they agreed to support the Zionist cause. Now, this leads to a very, very big question. Why? Why would England, why would Britain want to support the Zionists? What are they gaining out of this? And here we have a whole bunch of theories, some of which border on conspiratorial and bizarre. Allah knows best. I will mention basically four reasons, and there are more than these. I will mention four reasons that at least the first three I kind of am sympathetic to. The last one I'm so about. The first reason, and by the way, this topic of why the Brits wanted to support the Zionists is a very interesting topic. And as I said, you get a lot of theories and some of them really are conspiratorial, and I just want to dismiss those outright. The first reason that I think is very clear, and there's no denying this, the same reason why every single politician makes promise to members of his own congregation, his own group, and that is for their support. You make promises to your people, to segments of your people, right? When a politician is running for office, he's going to promise the gun holder something. He's going to promise the abortions something. He's going to promise, you know, elderly people something. It's a part of what you do as a politician, right? You gather their support. And the Jewish population in England was, relatively speaking, powerful and wealthy. And like every political party, there's nothing sinister about this. What does a politician do? You want the support of those people. So the British Parliament felt the need to get the support of Britain's Jews. That's reason number one. Directly from this reason number two, one of the richest and most powerful Jews in all of England was Chaim Weizmann himself. And Chaim Weizmann in particular was very much needed by the British. Why? Because Chaim Weizmann wasn't just rich because of having some businesses and whatnot. He was in the business of producing acetone, which was a necessary ingredient in the manufacture of bombs and explosives. And with the advent of war, the price of acetone and the availability of acetone starts to become very, very important. And Chaim Weizmann was a chemist, by the way. And he patented a new technique of acetone. This is before World War I. This is basically a stroke of luck or whatever you want to call it, that his expertise was acetone. He had a company that produced acetone, and acetone is a necessary ingredient in the making of bombs. And the Brits now desperately need him to increase the supply of acetone by 1,000%. So it could be, and he happens to be the president or the secretary of the World Zionist Federation, right? So it could be that by promising him Jerusalem, you get him on your side. And this is a very logical and rational reason to promise something, right? And it is said that when the issue of payments came up, how much should England give Weizmann's company? How much would be the going rate? He's already a multi-billionaire, one of the richest men of Europe. His response was, I don't want any money. I want Palestine. I don't need any money from you. I want Palestine. That's my payment, right? And this makes sense that why would he want any money when he himself is a very rich person? So it could be one of the reasons they're supporting the Zionist cause is to get Chaim Weizmann and his company to produce acetone, which is a very reasonable explanation as well. A third reason that is given, was hinted at by the person that was speaking in our video, and that is the Christian connection with Judaism and the fulfillment of the messianic prophecies of the second coming of Jesus. It is bizarre for most Muslims to know this, but actually many Christians are more pro-Zionist than most Jews. We as Muslims, most of us are ignorant about this. Some of the Christian fundamentalist groups are more pro-Zionist than Jewish groups. And the reason for this is because they believe that when the Holy Land is ready, Jesus Christ will return again. And they want to expedite the process. And no doubt they, fundamentalist Christians, think Jews are misguided, but they think Jews are misguided because they haven't been updated yet. For us, they view us as being not even on the chart of misguidance. We're not even on the chart. We're completely off the charts. Jews are, they lost the plot because they didn't believe in Jesus. That's what they believe. For us, they believe we are not even on the path of guidance. So there's more sympathy to Jews, obviously, because in the end of the day, Jesus was a Jew. He came for the Jews. I mean, they all acknowledge this. There's more familiarity with the Jews. And we are considered to be heathens and barbarians and following a false prophet. That's their view. And the Prime Minister of England, Lloyd George at the time, was an ardent evangelical Christian. And he clearly had pro-Zionist and very Christian tendencies when he wants to conquer Jerusalem and whatnot. You see yourself, what you saw yourself, his statements and whatnot. And there's no denying that there's an element of pro-Zionism coming out of a Christian theology. Okay, so this is reason number three. And again, I don't see any conspiracy here. It's pretty obvious. You believe in something, you're going to do it. The fourth reason given, this is where I say, Allahu A'lam, it's a bit of a conspiracy. I don't know. I don't know, I'll just say it, and I don't know if it's true or not. There is a theory, you'll find it in a lot of books, but I'm not an expert in this, so I just mention it and I'll leave it at that. That by promising Palestine to the Jews, this was a bribe to certain high-ranking officials in the White House to try to drag America into the war as well. And this is a theory that is given. And they mention some names and whatnot, that this was some type of, you know, promise that America would also get involved. But, you know, Allahu a'lam if this is true or not, but let me say one thing, and this is shocking to many of us, but it's historically true. Mainstream American Judaism was completely opposed to Zionism for the first 40 years of Zionism. Mainstream American Judaism, 1880s, 1890s, it was a European phenomenon. Zionism was a completely European phenomenon. American Jews, by and large, scoffed at the idea of an independent Jewish homeland. They thought this is ridiculous. We're happy where we are. You know, we're acclimatized. We love America. There was no notion, and they did understand it would cause problems and whatnot. And mainstream Jews in America did not.
All right, we are back. I wanted to wind it up a little because he made the case. He made the case that what Arabs think. They think about the fact that, you know, why the Brits promise the Jewish people their Jewish land? How come, you know, they allow the Jewish people to come back? For that record, you know, yesterday was the fast of Nine and Av. You know, it's the destruction of the temple day. It's a memory for that. And we fast. It's a fast that for almost 2,000 years, we are fasting every year the same time. Now, people who remember how much in pain they were when they lost the land, and they fast every year to come back. You ask him for a reason why England did the right thing. England knew what she's doing. England chose to be truthful to God. And that's why they gave. Of course, the policy, the politicking of all ruined the continuation of the idea. The idea in 1917 was clear. The Jewish land in the land called Palestine. That land was Turks before, but the Roman, you know, gave her the name of Palestine. And I don't know why the Turks didn't call it a different name, because if Palestine was given by the Roman, and after there was the Turk, the Ottoman Empire, they should have renamed it. But for some reason, they did not. Anyway, the fact of the matter is, going back to the Jewish land was normal, 1917. Then some politics come, and there goes the sheikh from Saudis and asks for a half of the land. I don't know what bribe he gave there. Let's talk about that, because the mandate to Palestine was given by the League of Nations, was given with the entitlement of the Jewish people to the land. And now they took it and gave it to the half of it to the Hashemite kingdom, which they are huffing and puffing and give us a hard time. And we mentioned that we want to continue their, you know, our relationship and our friendship. But the truth of the matter needs to be said always. You guys have a half of the land of Palestinian and then ask us for more. It's ludicrous to even consider that. All right, so there goes the English. And I have a segment from Mr. Lloyd George that speaks to the nation. Let's listen to it to understand what kind of a nation Britain was then, before the Second World War, okay?
No human system is perfect. But the system of free ports, with all its faults, has built up for us the greatest international trade in the world, the greatest shipping in the world, the greatest aggregation of ports in the world, the greatest expert of manufactured goods per head of the population in the whole world. We are the richest country in Europe. We pay the highest wages of any country in Europe except Denmark, which is also free trade. And we're the lowest cost of living of any country in the world. All this we are asked to fling away in a moment of bewilderment. The real aim of this election has been very cunningly concealed in the folds of the Union Jack. Its purpose is to convert this country into a mere copy of protectionist Germany, with every essential commodity taxed heavily at the ports, including the food of the people. I earnestly entreat my countrymen to pause before they rush headlong into this revolutionary change, which may well be irretrievable. The real purpose of the advocates of this change is to divert the attention of the people from the real evils and the right remedies.
All right. We are back. It's Orly Benny Davis with Impossible Truth. I was giving you a segment because sounding like Donald Trump of today, because England was the biggest, the greatest, and the most powerful nation probably in the world. And sure enough, things changes. So we have to remember always that there is a God and it's not us. And we need to be graceful to whatever we have and be thankful, no matter what's the challenges. And I know that so many people are having, you know, smoke in their eyes. They can't see the right thing, you know, to do. And the challenges and those broken houses that we all live with need to be taken care of. And whenever you want to have a grace, you just pray, you know. Just remember that you're never alone. You always have God on your side because you're His creation. And every one of us is countable, and it's important for you to remember that. And I know people try to take a lot of remedies to change. They take pills, they take drugs, they drink, they do all sort of things to forget about themselves. But sometimes, you know, you just get yourself together. Be strong. Be stronger, because you are stronger than you think. And you're always stronger. And because you're not alone, you always have God on your side. Just remember. But try to be on His side too. And on His side in this time of challenge is very easy to be. You just do the right thing. And doing the right thing, you can do whatever it takes. Change your life, make it better, be kind, be honest, be graceful. And if you have and if you're in the loop, you said you cannot get out of it, you try to go and correct the last mistake you did. Because sometimes people keep on going with the big mistake of their life and thinking that, oh, it will go away, it will go away. But they find themselves in a loop. And sometimes going back and asking people for forgiveness is a good thing. And then you never know. I remember a story about somebody I'm not going to mention that was in a loop. And I said, you know what? I remember you had a good fiancé. She was beautiful. She was honest. She was graceful. You gave her a ring and then you dumped her and nothing happened. And you, since then, you're still running around your tail. He said to me, okay, what shall I do? He said, just go and ask her for forgiveness. And sure enough, he left and he asked her for forgiveness. And she introduced him to his next wife. So, by all means, let's get some music and we'll be back after that.
you so easy to give my heart away.
But I found out. All right, we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis with Impossible Truth. Now, Oliver Stone made a lot of difference because he went to Russia and interviewed Putin, and he made he has a different perspective. He also cares for this world. Sometimes he does not really understand all the details, so somebody can sell him some stories, because I can see from his rhetoric that he's not getting it all as far as the Middle East goes. But I want you to listen to it. Maybe there is one angle that he can renew to us. Let's listen to him.
If you said subtly that you preferred X candidate, he would go like that tomorrow. And if you say you didn't like Trump or something, right, what would happen? He'd win, right? You have that amount of power in the U.S.
Мы, в отличие от многих наших партнеров, никогда не вмешиваемся во внутриполитические процессы других стран.
That's the one and only Oliver Stone, of course, in his latest flick, The Putin Interviews, a four-hour documentary airing this week on Showtime. Tucker sat down with Stone last night to ask him about his experience with the Russian president, Washington's war against President Trump, and a whole lot more.
So Oliver Stone, you spent 20 hours interviewing Vladimir Putin, I think more than any Westerner ever, probably. Polls in the last year have shown a growing sense among Americans that Russia is our chief enemy. Do you think Russia sees us that way?
I would say that comes because of media pressure and the amount of interviews given by the government calling them the number one existential threat. The military commanders have said
what's
so.
The motive there? Why would the
our
press?
Motive,
yeah, why you're saying that the American press is creating antagonism where it doesn't naturally exist? Why would they do
the
that?
The American government, and whether the American press is to a sense corporate media and represents a corporate government point of view. It's in our interest to have enemies. Russia always been an enemy for the most part.
But it's liberals who are mad at you for making this film. I've seen an hour of it, and it is friendly. But they're attacking you as a lapdog of Putin that you've sold out. I mean, you've gotten a hostile reception from the American left. I always thought of you as a part of the American left.
It goes to
why?
Show you that nothing is what it seems. You know, there's all kinds of fracturing. There is a progressive left, and much of the progressive left divorced from Hillary Clinton in the election. People like myself went third party. The reason was that she essentially had become, in the last 20 years, has become a neoconservative. She has backed all the neocon, basically the invasion of Libya, the destruction of Libya, which is crucial. She backed the Iraqi war resolutions. She has been a major figure in attacking the Syrian sovereignty of the Syrian government. This is very important. So, in a sense, we have destroyed the sovereignty of these countries in the Middle East. It's Libya, Iraq, and now Syria, or we're trying to destroy Syria. Very important. If this crumbles, the Middle East crumbles. And the world order, which is very important to Mr. Putin, a sense of law, a sense of fundamental principles, has gone out the window. He talks about it.
Well, that's the opposite of the way he's presented here as someone, you know, he's presented as an autocrat who doesn't care about law, and by the way, who hacked our democracy and undermined our elections.
Though. We don't know that. We're told that. And
do you believe that?
You're jumping around, Tucker, but we have to have evidence of this. There's a thin amount of evidence, and it's been told to us by three agencies, the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI. It was told to us in January, a few days before Mr. Trump came into office. It was as much, it was called an assessment, thin, the report itself, if you read it, as I think Stephen Cohen has pointed out to you, is not an intelligence estimate. It's not, it doesn't have dissent, doesn't have the kind of information that is required. It's kind of, as Cy Hirsch said, it was a joke. And he faults John Brennan, the head of the CIA, as being creating a fear and a paranoia without evidence at a time in a transition when it's very important in American democracy that we trust our leaders. So Trump was, in a sense, slapped in the face with 2 weeks to go. I mean, this thing is serious. It's calling Trump essentially a Manchurian candidate. That's as hostile as it's ever been in a transition.
But you've seen that again and again. I mean, there was just a story out that the investigation into Trump, headed by former FBI Director Robert Mueller, apparently FBI agents are leaking details of that investigation to the press. And you're seeing leaks from all the different intel agencies against the administration. Seems like they're trying to change their policies.
That's correct.
Does that surprise you?
Well, the overtness of it does. If the investigation were to continue, which it probably will, I think that they have to go back to the origins of that leak in January. Who put out that information? Who gave it to the New York Times or Washington Post back channel? You have to ask these questions. It seems as if some people have said, and I tend to agree, the deep state, the military industrial complex, the intelligence agencies have their own position and have had it for many years, and they continue to promote the wars that they do in all these countries. And even Obama said, well, I want to close Guantanamo, I want to cut down on Afghanistan, I want to do this and I want to do that. He didn't do it. You have to ask yourself, who is running the country?
Doesn't the president get to decide the policies?
You'd think so. You'd think so, but I think we need a thorough examination of what's going on. I'm shocked at what the CIA did and what Brennan did. It seemed like he was very hostile to Trump, very hostile, and I think Comey carried it out. It was Comey, if anybody, influenced the election, in my opinion. It was Comey's declaration that the investigation on Clinton had been dropped, and then he reopened it 3 weeks or 2 weeks before.
Have you talked to President Trump in the last year or so?
No, I directed him in a film, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. It was a deleted scene, not his fault, but it was interesting to work with him for that day as an actor.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
He's still an actor.
Oliver Stone, good to see you.
Thank you, Tucker,
for
giving me the time.
All right, we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis. That was Oliver Stone. And he said what we all think, but he said in a way that we can understand it clearly. There is a tempering of the presidential position by leaking from the government of offices, by media pressure, by trying to destabilizing the relationship that we have in the world. And by all means, right now, President Trump did sign the sanction against North Korea, Iran, and Russia. To put those three together, it's obviously not right. It's not right because Russia is not North Korea and Iran. Come on. Russia did it parts when we asked her in 2013. And I cannot stop being grateful for her not to make it, for putting, saving the day by taking all the chemical weapon. Not all, of course. There is, he said some other people got a hold of it, and I hope that we're not living with a reality that hostile power have chemical weapon on the grounds in the north. But think about it. To put a sanction against Russia after they tried to play it right, they want to be a player in the world. And for some reason, this old world order does not like it. And as Oliver Stone said so well, he said Hillary Clinton was the neoconservative, and neoconservative, like I don't know what she is, but she wants, she helped destroy Libya. She helped destroy Iraqi, of course, war, because she supported it. And then she was, she was instrumental to the regime change in Syria, which did not succeed. What are we going to do about her? What are we going to do about their obsession with the Middle East? They wander around this show and they send us all their goons to try to sabotage Benjamin Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu is not an angel, that's for sure. It's not in that sort of an angel like they talk in the United Nations about terrorists. Like, they're not angels. No, they're not. They're definitely not angels. But we're talking about sabotaging and paying dues to overt, to change you know, the election in Israel. And sure enough, we got you. We got that. We understood it. And what happened? We stopped it and Benjamin Netanyahu won. Now maybe you'll have to quit because he has other things that happened. And I had somebody whisper in my ears a bad thing about what he probably did. But I am not saying it. I cannot say anything. I don't have proofs. And if you don't give me proof, I don't talk about it. It's like we have the impossible truth here. This is, if you want to talk to me, give me some real stuff. I'm not talking. I love Oliver Stone because he said it, but he was talking about the Palestinian issues, which I didn't like. Okay, so I'm not going to let you listen to it. All right. So let's go on. What do you think about this world of ours? What do you think about President Trump? Are we going to give him a chance and let him pass some legislation? And there is one, you know, the Taylor Force Act, the act that you don't pay terrorists after they kill somebody. And that's in the Congress. And all the goody tissues Democrats, they're not supporting it. Goody-two-shoes Democrats, they become obscene with their government representation of the people of America. I would call all American to drop those Democrats' representative. We're talking all of them. You need to change. If all of them don't care about you to work, they go there. And the only thing that they want to do, they want to sabotage Donald Trump that comes with all his family. He put everything online for you guys. And they want to sabotage because they're so indoctrinated with the Clinton regime. Because Clinton has a regime. She sabotaged the world. She uprised. She wants to uprise in Israel, you know. I don't know who didn't die in their time. Even Rabin died, okay? And we still have to figure out to kill them, okay? Because he didn't want to give up Jerusalem, which, you know, Clinton was thinking that it will be a good thing. And God, and what his priest said on his bed, and I will say it again, on his deathbed, he said to Mr. Clinton, if you ever forget Israel, God will never forgive you. And sure he did. So I guess this is it. We are ending our show right now, my show, and it's really nice to talk to you. I love every second, and it goes fast. I try. I hope that I made a point. I hope that I bring you closer to understand that you are godly and you're loved and you are incredible creation. And go get them. Do your best because the world is wonderful. America is great. Israel is holy and we should keep it holy. And all our friends in the Middle East, get your act together. It's time to change the page on history and make it all come true. Okay? So by all means, God bless you all. Ciao, ciao.